In June 2011, 54 American and international visitandines came together in St. Louis, Missouri, to celebrate the 400th anniversary of the Order of the Visitation of Holy Mary. For more information about the Order of the Visitation of Holy Mary, go to visitationspirit.org. The following talk is We Are an Echo of the Procession of the Virgin Mary's Visit to Elizabeth, by a visitation sister from St. Paul, Minnesota.
It's a joy to speak on this day when we celebrate the visitation and are so aware that the vision of Francis, of which we are the present part, the tail end up to now, is really an echo of that procession that Mary made across the hills of Judea, that first Eucharistic procession in which she carried the Lord to others. And that's what our educational ministry has been, a procession, a Eucharistic procession in which we carry the Jesus engendered within us to others. I don't know, Francis once said to his friend Bishop Commune, why people should look upon me as the founder of visitation. All I intended was to found a simple house at Annecy, and now we have a regular enclosed order. We're very familiar with what has been said and written, pen, a lot of ink spilled, about the changes that came to visitation when the Cardinal Archbishop of Lyon intervened in the structure. This bouleversement, it's Marie de la Trinité here, I'm using the French word, she's not here to hear it. This upturning of the original plan has been rationalized as a way of establishing the visitation in France. And that's the theory of Father Sandy Pochetto. It's been spoken of as the action of divine providence, or it's been interpreted as the will of God's good pleasure. On the other hand, another significant change in the visitation, also engendered by outside pressure in response to surrounding circumstances, the establishment of schools, and later their diminishment, has been all but ignored. Now, except for a few sisters in Germany and possibly in the city of Rome, there are no living visitation sisters in Europe who have a memory of a school connected to their monasteries. And sometimes the mention of a school seems to be accompanied by a bit of embarrassment, as if this is some violation of the plan. There seems to be among some a perception that the closing of the schools was because they were incompatible with the contemplative life. That played its part, and we'll get into that later. But I, as one who discovered my call to religious life through being a student of the visitation, like so many of you who are here because of having been students at the visitation, and as one who has worked in teaching and administration in several visitation schools, and now in my old age serving as a, quote, wisdom figure on the board of trustees, I have wondered, how did these schools come to exist when they weren't really planned? Research on this topic is quite difficult, especially on this side of the Atlantic. Much of the pertinent information about the early days of them and their origins is tucked away in obscure archives or death letters of European sisters. But for what it's worth, here we go with what I could dig up. At the beginning, both founders of the visitation were reluctant to admit school children. However, immediately, the pressure of society seems to have moved them to admit at least a few girls who were considering a future as religious, or at least their parents were. And if you remember, mostly religious vocations in the Middle Ages and even into the 17th century were determined by the pecking order in the family. Oh, here's our lovely oldest daughter, and we will give her a great dowry, and affiance her to this baron over here who has land adjoining ours, and that will be, and we can provide a great dowry. Well, Sally, you're the second daughter, and we're not going to have much money left. You can go to the convent. This was part of the societal situation in that day. But just a few weeks after the opening of the gallery house, Jane brought her 11-year-old daughter, Françoise, into the house. Now, Françoise really yearned to be a religious, and every time there was a reception of the habit or a profession, she would end up at the ceremony weeping because she wasn't a religious. But her own worldly ways made it very clear that she wasn't called to this, and Jane never let her put on the habit of the little sisters. She seemed to have had a happy life among the sisters there, though there is one anecdote related of the terrible Jean-Charlotte de Bréchard, who took away her pet sparrow because it was too distracting and the novices were wasting time with it. She did make it up. She made a set of dolls of paradise for the child, which impelled Francis to forbid the making of dolls, so it had its own repercussions. Now, in 1614, so we're 4 years beyond the foundation, Jeanne-Marguerite de la Chavanne joined the first community of Annecy at the age of 9, and soon received the little habit. She and Françon, who was by then 15 years old, became great friends, though the latter used to tease Jeanne about her pious practices. They played at being real visitandines with Mademoiselle de Chantal, always the superior, and Mademoiselle de la Chavanne as the humble sister receiving admonitions and penances. This first sister of the little habit received permission from Francis to make vows at age 15 in 1620 on her deathbed, but she died before this could be accomplished. Paralleling Jeanne Marguerite's early entry at Annecy, though conversely destined to live a long life, Anne-Claude Collin entered the community in 1615 when she was 10 years old. She had come with her mother, who accompanied Madame de Gouffier from Lyon to Annecy, and she received the little habit from Jane de Chantal. The early annals carry anecdotes of young Anne acting as a companion in the parlor to mothers de Chantal and Blonet. These young people were joined by the niece of Francis, Jeanne-Marie de la Croix. And one might well assume that Marie Rabutin de Chantal, the daughter of Salspinine, later to become Madame de Sévigné, visited often. Her needlepoint portrayal, oh, here we go. Murphy's Law rides again.
Cynthia.
To the rescue.
Am I okay? Oh, wait a minute. I know it. Okay, there we go. This is the needlepoint of Marie de Chantal, who was later de Sévigné, and it's an embroidery picture of the gallery house garden, and it's on the wall in the gallery. You can see it there, the actual original. Now, she wasn't born when they lived in the gallery house those first 18 months that they were there, but she must have visited there later. An additional member, young member of this group, may well have been Claudine Rabutin de Chantal. She was la fille donnée, which is a beautiful French way of speaking of an illegitimate child. She was Christophe's daughter, raised by Jane de Chantal, as most you probably know. Now, Claudine was not married by 1610 when Jane went to Savoy to start the visitation. She was married later to Nicolas Bussac, a Savoyard, and I'm guessing about 1613 because she had her first child at 1614. So presumably during those years between 10 and 13, 1610, 1613, it's reasonable to assume that she probably lived with her stepmother there at Annecy. Now, Father Alexander, or Sandy Puccetto, has pointed out that the provision for accepting a few girls, which was placed in the custom book in 1624, had previously been in the constitutions of 1613 as Article 24. The next set of constitutions, 1616, speak of receiving only one girl at a time and indicate that she should be at least 12 years old. There was also a provision made in that earlier constitution for the instruction of girls and women in the parlor about matters of religion. On Sundays they could come. And in 1620, Francis writes, "God has not selected your institute for the education of little girls, but for the perfection of women and young ladies." An absolute prohibition? Sounds like it, doesn't it? But the letter goes on. "It is true that these young people cause difficulties, but which is better, to have thorns in our garden that we may have roses, or to have no roses for fear of having thorns?" So you can see, even then, he's beginning to hedge on this. Francis, in writing to the Superior of Grenoble, who had received a request for entry from a 9-year-old, who was born, incidentally, simultaneously on June 6, 1610, with the order, she was asking to enter the community at age 10. He goes on to advise the Superior not to present the habit, but only a simple outfit with a tan or black scarf, so that the girl might feel she resembled religious. Now, actually, this scarf somehow seems to have become white. And this is out of the museum at Moulins. It was not on display the last time we were there in 29. Am I back in that century? Okay. We saw this in 1999 when we were there. And if you don't think that's an authentic habit, let me tell you that the top of that little white veil had the laundry mark of cross 37 right on it. So we know it's no made-up thing. It was actually went through the laundry and got back to the right owner. Here's another picture showing some of the sisters of the little habit. Note the two in the lower right-hand corner. Their veils follow the dictum mentioned that they aren't quite like the sisters, but the gimps are curved in distinction to the squared barbettes of the sisters, and Sister Jane Margaret had the two types there yesterday. We saw her day before yesterday. Here's another picture. This one comes from the monastery of Caen up in Brittany, which was established in 1631. It shows 9 little sisters. Now here you've got the square gimps or barbettes. Interesting. They had 9 of them You heard the prohibition about one and then maybe three. Okay. Now, Father Pochetto has traced the expansion of the pensionnat, or boarding schools, the gradual loosening of the limitations on the number of boarders that the various monasteries could take in. This next part, I'm very much indebted to Sandy for this material. He traced it through the correspondence that Sister Mary Pat Burns put together, the six volumes. And I checked it all out. What you do is you look up pensionnat and you follow out every reference to it. And that's exactly what he did. So here we go. Now, one of the first cautions about taking in girls not yet ready to receive the habit comes from practical rather than philosophical or spiritual reasoning. And here it is. You have indeed, this is from Holy Mother, very little space right now. By doing this, taking them in, you close the door to those able to receive it. Besides, so much youthfulness altogether will weigh down the mistress. How many of you school teachers can relate to that? In 1622, Jane writes to Mother Marie Jacqueline Fabre at Montferrand, if these two young girls have natural gifts and desire to be religious, you may take them with the permission of the bishop, but truly I think the fewer you take, the better. A year later, Jane cites the reluctance of our Blessed Father to receive a number of girls into the monastery, but she leaves the decision open to the discretion of the superior with the advice of the good fathers. Indication of the eagerness of parents to situate their daughters in convents and the resultant pressure upon the superiors is given in a letter from Mother de Chantal to a gentleman of Moulins in 1624. Apparently, he has requested the reception of the nun's habit for his daughter. Jane declares it a matter of conscience to delay this event with the girl in secular clothing for some months, and then the little habit before she receives that of the novice. I don't know too many parents like that today. Jane writes to a mother superior to provide for teaching young girls through the visitation if there are no Ursulines in the city. This letter also gives a clue concerning the omission of the Article 24 in the earlier constitutions. And it was left out of the custom book also. And here's why. Our Blessed Father withdrew this article on the instruction of seculars to avoid all umbrage, don't you love that word, umbrage, and jealousy, because this holy man wanted peace above all else. Apparently, recruitment among religious was very competitive. Now, in 1629, Jane is still resisting the increase of boarders. Six had been proposed for a new foundation, and she suggests the compromise of instructing them and their friends in the parlor. About the same time, however, Jane writes to a bishop that, quote, instruction is more proper to schoolmistresses than to those of our profession who are called to a regular and withdrawn life. As pressure mounts, Jane becomes a little more open to more than three pensionnaires, depending on who is doing the asking. And she tells the bishop at Thon to take two girls, which brings the number in that monastery to four. To another bishop, she graciously responds, they will follow his advice, but expresses the desire that the number be not too large, and that they be not too young, nor incapable of receiving instruction in piety and a good education. A letter written in the last year of Jane's life grants to an unidentified superior the right to use her own judgment in surpassing the prescribed limits of girls in the monastery. Now, according to her famous biographer, Abbé Émile Bougot, Jane de Chantal directs Mother de Choisy to write to convents to receive without scruple all the scholars that present themselves. I couldn't find that letter, but Bugo says it's there. He also cites his indication of Jane's approval of young boarders, her journey through France with visits to the monastery of Paris, Lyon, Autun, Montferrand, Montpellier, and Avignon. At each stop, she meets the boarders, and they recite poetry and sing songs for her. She caresses them, blesses them, teaches them practices of piety, and gives them little rewards. Stickers, maybe? From all this evidence and more of the alleviation from the hard and fast numbers stated in the rules, Father Sandy has concluded, from this we can infer that the boarding schools of the Visitandines took off in both number and size, so much so that practically all of the monasteries had a pensionnat. Indeed, by 1635, still within Jane's lifetime, there are a dozen pupils of Annecy. This fact is casually indicated in an account of a mysterious light emanating from a picture of Francis at the time when the whole community was praying for his canonization. The phenomenon is witnessed by, and this is in the account, 12 girls sleeping in a room with one sister, obviously a boarding school dormitory. And less than 25 years after Jane's death in 1664, Madeleine Françoise de Chauchy writes, most of our houses have boarding scholars. The second house of Annecy has generally 12 or 15. They occupy, however, a different part of the building. This is the same in Rumilly and Chambéry. When he founded the house in Turin, our worthy prelate, of course that's Francis, so firmly established this custom that our sisters there have generally from 20 to 25 scholars. Now, we're still not to our 545, I think we have in St. Paul. But it's on the way. Now, what happened at the pensionnat? The numbers seem to have warranted adaptation of the buildings. A circular letter from Fourcalquier in 1735 speaks of a little refectory for the young lady boarders. And this is a quote, indispensable for delivering the sisters during meals from these little people. And a circular from Nancy in 1749 describes rooms for two classes equipped with tables and drawers containing paper, pens, and pencils. At the museum in Moulins, there's a floor plan of the school at, oh, skip one. Let's see if I can go back. Oh, it's not on there. I don't know what happened. I had a nice picture of the floor plans, but it's not there. It's kind of like a blueprint showing the floor plan at Rouen. And on the, skip two. Something's amiss. Okay, I had a lovely picture from Peelenhofen. Maybe I'll get it later and you can look at it, but I can't get it now. A photo from Peelenhofen shows a well-equipped and well-populated social studies classroom, probably from the late 19th century. These all came from Girard Picot at Moulins, but they all worked beforehand, but of course, as I said, Murphy's Law always prevails when you do AB stuff. What about the curriculum? What was taught there? Now, Frances Massacre is the biographer of Madame de Sévigné, and she discusses the schooling of Françoise de Sévigné, who later became de Grignan, who is the great-granddaughter of Jane. She was educated at the Visitation in Paris. I couldn't find out whether it was first or second. They were both in existence during her childhood. And then at Nantes in Brittany, where the de Sévignés had property, and when the mother went up to Brittany, she would go to school in Nantes. When they were down in Paris, she would go to school there, but they were both Visitation. Massacre dismisses the quality of education lightly. She says, in the 17th century France, the curriculum was notoriously skimpy, few nuns being qualified to instruct in anything beyond the catechism. A young lady of quality would be taught how to scrawl a letter of condolence or of congratulations, how to sew a fine seam, how to raise her voice in song, preferably religious, how to make a graceful entry into and exit from a salon. She concludes that Françoise de Sévigné must have had a tutor because she was obviously well-educated in the kind of letters she wrote to her mother and the way her mother wrote to her. Well, that's very nice to draw that conclusion based on an assumption which is unsupported. So I tend to argue with Frances Massacre, who likes to look on the seamy side and negative side of things, but anyway, there it is, for what it's worth. The passages in the custom book regarding young women do deal most explicitly with religious exercises. For example, here's a quote, "First of all, they shall love the Lord with all their heart, doing everything for love of Him. And in another place, they shall be trained and formed in spiritual things with much sweetness, according to their little capacity, by a sister who is very gentle and prudent. Further, they shall observe their little rules very faithfully, cheerfully, and willingly, and a prayer book was composed for them." Now, our custom book also states that in addition to exercises in piety, our dear little sisters will go to their mistress to learn what will be useful. And at that time, the novices were to study Latin, French, penmanship, spelling, arithmetic, sewing, and would you believe, filing. Boy, I could use one of those helpers. It seems reasonable that these were the same courses of studies for the Sisters of the Little Habit. Now, in a letter to Mother Marie-Hélène de Chaffigny at Moulin, Jane promises to send directories for the Little Sisters. Presumably, these directories contain more specific information concerning the curriculum than can be found in the custom book. Now, Mother Rose Marie and Sister, now Mother Sharon Elizabeth, told us about seeing in the display at Annecy some manuals of instruction on display. And maybe you saw them, Berkman's, huh? You talked about them? Okay. Oh, they were as late as that. That's 19th century then. Okay, I thought they were earlier. We've never laid eyes on them in this country. Somebody?
I saw them also.
Oh, you saw them too.
In this case, and I had a look at the picture on the front of the little girl. You know,
okay. But Mother de Chappuis was 19th century, so we're a couple centuries on. So these would not have been the ones Jane was writing about, probably. Okay. Most of the clues about courses of study come from a later era, just what we're seeing now. Now, we do learn that in the 18th century, the girls were learning to make ink designs in Chinese style. They were studying geography and spelling and were memorizing according to their age and capacity. A century later, in the first monastery of Paris, there were courses in logic, history of philosophy, cosmography, and various art techniques. Now, this diagram up here, I have no date for. It indicates that there was some rather advanced scientific stuff going on. And here's another one. Here's our cosmography, I believe, and another. There seems to have been a fairly serious interest in science. Also at Milan are these boxes, which may have been used for art materials or perhaps ink and pens. And Gérard was kind enough to email these pictures to me. Now, were there teachers from beyond the community of sisters, even male teachers? A circular from Caen in 1763, so we're now 150 years beyond the foundation years, speaks of the construction of a new building with parlors on the first floor for, quote, the masters of music design, and geography. Who were these masters? I know not, but isn't that fun to hear? Apparently, the students were also doing some sort of drama work, for tragedies were being composed for them. Now, though possibly destined for religious life, and that was the kind of cover story for these girls, though a lot of them certainly didn't enter the religious life, but the students were not sedate miniature adults. We have a record that at Chalon-sur-Saône in 1698, a 15-year-old fell into the salt bin and she climbed out on a tall ladder lowered down to her. There is also, at the first monastery of Avignon, there's an ex-voto picture of a pupil falling out of a window. So whatever these girls were doing, well, take it or leave it. I remember, it reminded me of Vistry, every year in Vistry, which is a group of girls from the different visitation schools in this country that come together to do social work or service work. Every year we come up with a new rule according to what happens each year. And the last year they were at Mendota Heights, we had to add the rule, do not climb on the roof. You know, it's very similar to this situation. Teenage girls are ever the same. Now what about the financial aspects? During the first half of the 17th century, the reception of boarders seems to have resulted from the pressure of their families rather than to provide an income. Apparently, the only means considered at that time for sustaining monasteries financially were dowries of the sisters and donations from patrons. When Jane speaks of dowries, she makes it clear that spiritual qualities of novices are far more important than fiscal heritage. For example, she notes the entrance into the first monastery of Paris as the rather famous Hélène Angélique Rillet. And here's what Jane says about her. She's of great quality and well-known, who donated 15,000 écus, whatever that amounts to help the foundation. But what pleases me more is that she has a very good heart and a well-formed spirit. So it's clear that Jane was not, you know, milking these young women for their money. In speaking of dowries, Jane makes a charming play on words, and I don't know if I can get this across to you in English. She states she would rather have the gold of a good soul than argent. And our French ladies aren't here to say that argent means both money and silver. So she'd rather have gold of a good heart than silver. Or argent, money. I couldn't find any references in Jane's letters concerning payment, and I looked under every word I could think of in the index of the correspondence, which is very well indexed. It was done by computer, and it's kind of a concordance, really, to those six volumes. Couldn't find anything about payment for the pensionnaire. But with the passage of time, maintaining boarders became a financial necessity for many visitation monasteries. Grave material difficulties forced a number of houses in France to close their doors. And ironically, the agency intended to assist religious in bearing the very name of help caused further issues. The Commission de Secours, and secours means help, the Commission of Help, named by the king in 1727 to remedy the disasters of the majority of religious communities, constitutes another danger for a number of monasteries of the Visitation. This quotation, by the way, it's a rather long one, is from the book that came out from Annecy in celebration of their 400 years, and I think most of you have received, I did a translation of that book and sent it around email to, I think, all of your communities. If you haven't looked at it, you might do so. It's a fascinating book. And the pictures in the original French are beautiful. And if you put my typewritten copy next to it, you might put the two together. Anyway, This was another danger, according to this account from Annecy. Wanting to grant rapid help to prevent the eventual ruin of numerous houses, the commission puts a priority on suppressing the useless communities. That's in quotes. Convents of women do not merit survival as useful to the state through edification and prayer, but through teaching and education of children. Several monasteries of the Visitation have their very existence threatened, and to avoid eventual suppression, they take up education of girls. And then it goes on to say, indeed, in spite of the formal prohibition of the founders against taking in girls for education, and here's the quote from the custom book of the definitive one, was that 1637, I think, except two or three or four at most, about 10 to 12 years old, who aspire to the religious life, one soon finds in the monastery young boarding students beyond the number permitted by the custom book. Without doubt, the interpretation is rather broad. The custom does allow receiving girls for education, so that the need to provide means of sustenance explains this stretching of the rule. The financial disasters in France in the 18th century easily explain its continuation. Now, we all know that by the time of the revolution, there was a suppression of not only the schools, the monasteries, everything. They disappeared, and for a period about 1792 until usually after the Napoleonic era, often until about 1820, the monasteries didn't exist. Somewhere in there, it varies from house to house. Now, about the reestablishment. After the revolution and the terror, many of the monasteries of France were reestablished, and with them, the schools. Indeed, it was the schools themselves which provided not only the means of livelihood, but also the approval of the government. Under the First Empire, the Visitandines came to be known and authorized as educators and hospital workers. And then it became necessary to perform functions of public utility. The First Council, not understanding the value of the contemplative life. From that situation comes the growth of boarding schools, although the number of directresses and pupils is limited. By 1808, there are already 19 monasteries of the Visitation and 20 in the midst of reconstitution, with boarding schools of 30 students in each. Now, what happened in Rome about all this with the Pope? A variety of responses concerning the appropriateness of conducting schools has come from Rome. From Pignerol comes the note that Pius IX approved keeping the boarding schools and said that if our Holy Father were now living, he would establish them, since the good of the church called for them. Pope Pius X, upon being asked about the compatibility of the schools with the contemplative life, answered in the brief commemorating the third centenary, we heard about that this morning in relation to one of these women of prayer, he answered and sent this out to the Superior of Annecy that they should give primacy to the contemplative life. And I think that Sister Mary Berkman's is going to show that the two can exist side by side. That's part of what she's going to tell us. In the Apostolic Constitution, Sponsor Christi, 1952, I believe, Pius XII, while reiterating that the contemplative life is the first and primary end of nuns, establishes the means for monasteries to conduct schools. And that's why we put Sister Susan Marie on for this morning to talk about our primary outreach is prayer, but in the Visitation, though there have been other ministries of retreats and certainly living among the neighbors in a poor neighborhood, as we see in Minneapolis, the second apostolic work has been, through the centuries, our schools. Now, many of the schools have been suppressed. And the closing of the European schools has been described as the result of yearning for the contemplative life without the distractions of teaching. And this concept may well have played its part, as it has in some or maybe all of the monasteries in the United States where this has happened, but the more obvious and decisive cause of closure was, in France at least, the anti-clericalism rising up in Europe at the end of the 1800s. By 1905, the government of France had outlawed all religious schools. And here's a quotation from the New World Encyclopedia. During the 1880s, Jules Ferry, then Minister of Education, began to expel priests and nuns from public schools. The Jules Ferry laws established universal free education in 1881 and mandatory and lay education, providing the basis of modern French public education. These laws were a crucial step in the secularist foundation of the maturing Third Republic of France. A 1905 law on secularism was enacted by the government of radical socialist Émile Combes, meeting violent protests by the clergy and their supporters. Most Catholic schools and educational foundations were closed, and many religious orders were dissolved. And a similar situation existed in Spain, though I haven't documented it, where a number of schools had flourished. Now, I hate to leave poor Emile up there. You know, he's kind of our enemy, but I'll go back to something. I'll just go back to this original thing. As I talk my very last piece, as part of this examination of visitation schools, I found it interesting to look at the products of such education. By their fruits, you shall know them. Now, back there on the computer, and many of you have looked at it, and I hope the rest of you will have a chance to look at it. It takes about 8 minutes if you wait for the 15-second turning. If the blurb is short, just push the right-hand arrow, and you can move right through it in less than 8 minutes. It begins, or it includes 32 women and one man. Oh, now I've added one more, 33 women and one man, who received their education in the visitation, beginning with Jane's own daughter, Françoise, and leading up to someone like Liz McCartney, who was the CNN hero of 2008. Now, one of my favorites on there is an alumna of Sonnenburg in Bavaria, who was the last Empress of Austria and Queen Consort of Hungary. I think I like her because of her name. She was one of 24 children, so I don't know why they had to give her this name, all these names, but her name was given name, not even her surname. Zita Maria delle Grazie Aldegonda Michele Raffaella Gabriella Giuseppina Antonia Luisa Agnese. She grew up in Italy, even though she was, I don't know, she married in the Habsburg. She was a Bourbon, so go figure. Her name was Bourbon, her last name, French. She had all these Italian first names and married the Duke of Austria, so whatever she was. She ended up in the United States and visited Wilmington. I found in there, Silver is Mine, there's an account of her visit to Wilmington. So it's kind of fun. You will see that this collection back on the computer, if you haven't seen it already, you'll know it's unbalanced. The number of St. Paul graduates is disproportionate, of course, because that's the list I know best. But there are guesses and there are errors. I thought there were 5 Federation presidents who were products of his schools. There are 6, and I added one yesterday. And there are all kinds of alumni who have not been included. And I found one from Parkersburg today who was an opera singer through the help of Mary Ellen Meyer. So I would like and beg for your help in submitting names, correcting errors, and so on. And I hope to develop this into something really correct and historical and get it onto our website and make it available to all of you. But even this small compendium stands as a strong witness to the power of visitation education. It includes two canonized saints, two venerables, a martyr, some Olympic athletes, telecast anchor people, authors,
state senators,
and so on. So it's full of remarkable people. As I say, Zita is my favorite, and I think it's because of her name. Conclusion. Francis de Sales envisioned, first of all, a small diocesan congregation of women with simple vows, leading a life of prayer, and serving in a limited fashion the sick poor of their neighborhood. Second, he insisted on the little office of the Blessed Virgin for the communal prayer. Third, he advised against the operation of schools as quite distracting. Now, during his own lifetime, number one, changed drastically. And to this change, Francis acquiesced gracefully, understanding that the will of God's good pleasure could be known only in the events as they transpire. The second provision was changed after Vatican II, when the divine office became vernacular and simpler. The third major change, for some monasteries, that of conducting schools, has come about through societal pressure, financial necessity, and the outreach to assist Holy Church and the salvation of neighbor, which flows inevitably from lives of prayer. This third significant alteration in the visitation seems to be part of a broad pattern played out during its 400-year history. A pattern of full acceptance of divine providence by its members, a total embracing of the will of God's good pleasure.
For more information about the Order of the Visitation of Holy Mary, go to visitationspirit.org.